Thank you, Sarah. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm very happy to be on that call to discuss recent events and broader context for the recent events. I would say that the recent eruption of violence along the Israel-Lebanon border in the last few days signifies perhaps a new phase in the showdown between Israel and Iran and Hezbollah, which has been going on for several years now. And in order to better understand what happened in recent days, I would like to put things in a broader context. The main factor behind what's been going on in Lebanon, in Syria, and also in Iraq are the Iranian ambitions and the Iranian plans to make use of the turmoil characterizing the Middle East over the last nearly a decade, years of war, of turmoil, the rise and fall of ISIS, and so on. And Iran wanted to fill the void and establish itself as the dominant factor in the heart of the Middle East between Mesopotamia, the Levant, and the Mediterranean, especially in areas where there are Shiite communities. And these plans took a turn or a leap forward beginning in 2016 following the signing of the Iranian nuclear deal, the JCPOA, in 2015, and the fact that the war on ISIS turned a page in favor of Iran, Assad in Syria, and their allies. Iran felt emboldened, and that year, it designed a plan. It was that plan was fought by Qasem Soleimani, the commander of the Quds Force of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. And that plan had two main components. One was to build a what we now call the kind of a direct corridor stretching from Iran to through Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon to the Mediterranean. An additional element was to build Syria as a formidable military front facing Israel, joining the one that had already existed in Lebanon, where Iran provided Hezbollah with well over 100,000 rockets and missiles. As far as is known to Israeli intelligence community, Soleimani's plan in 2016 to build Syria as a military front included the deployment of Iranian forces in Syria, the deployment of up to 100,000 proxy militia forces in Syria, including they wanted to build a Syrian Hezbollah similar to the one in Lebanon, the deployment of thousands of rockets aimed at Israel, the establishment of defense industries integrated with the Syrian defense industries, the deployment of Iranian planes in Syrian air bases, and deployment of drones. The Iranians wanted a war in each of the two Mediterranean ports. They wanted intelligence collection bases along Israel's border and establish a series of them. And they wanted to build an operation infrastructure in southern Syria facing Israel. So that was a very ambitious plan. For Israel, it was a major challenge because if you build Syria as such a military front, joining the one in Lebanon, then if war erupts, that would constitute a major military challenge for Israel, which is why Israeli military planners at one point not only spoke about the third Lebanon war, but also about the northern war, where you have the two fronts, the Syrian and the Lebanese ones, challenging Israel. Given these ambitious plans, in 2017, our then Chief of Staff, Gadi Eisenkot, General Eisenkot, went to the cabinet and got approval to launch an Israeli campaign to block the Iranian plans. It was a campaign. And since then, Israel took action in Syria to thwart the Iranian plans as part of an operation concept known as the campaign between the wars. Namely, you take action to deny the enemy strategic military capabilities, but you do so in a way that does not escalate into war. You buy time, you enhance your deterrence, but you don't escalate to war. You're willing to escalate if need be, but you're careful and try not to. It was not an easy campaign, it rather complicated the operational theater, and you also have Russia there in the last few years, and we had some complications with Russia, but basically Israeli leadership managed to reach understandings with the Russian leadership that we will take action where they are unwilling to take action as long as we do not endanger Russian soldier or assets or the very stability of the Assad regime. And if you take what happened in recent years, if you compare the Iranian initial plans in Syria and where they are today, you see that Israel was rather successful and thwarted most of their plans. They don't have planes in Syria. They have drones, but many of them were taken out. They scaled down their military deployment. They don't have the amount of militia forces they wanted. They don't have wharves. That's mainly because Russia didn't want them to have. All of their intelligence bases facing Israel were destroyed, and they are far from establishing the operational bases they wanted in southern Syria. But that being said, they did not give up, and they continued to push. What they did is adjust their plans to Israeli pressure, go underground in certain cases, act in a more decentralized manner, and so on. A major component of the Iranian plan was what we call the precision project, namely to take part of Hezbollah's imprecise rockets and turn it into a very highly accurate rocket. As we know, Hezbollah has an arsenal of estimated by our intelligence at about 130 projectiles, namely missiles, rockets, and mortars. And the Iranian plan was to convert at least 1,000 rockets into very accurate ones with the precisions of up to 10 meters. Initially, beginning 2013, it's an old plan, Iran tried to supply Hezbollah with the rockets themselves, to ship them from Iran to Lebanon, but they were targeted by Israel, and that effort did not succeed. Then in 2015-16, Iran decided to build conversion facilities in Syria itself, and they were targeted by Israel, and most of them were destroyed. And then they moved to build conversion facilities in Lebanon, in underground sites. Some of them were exposed by our prime minister in a public speech at the UN Security Council. So they moved to other sites. But essentially what happened, given Israel's pressure in Syria, is that important elements of this precision project were moved by Iran to Iraq and to Lebanon. In Iraq, they provided the Shiite proxy militias with accurate rockets, not a big number, but several accurate rockets with a range to Israel. And in Lebanon, they continued to build those conversion sites. The conversion means that you take a dumb rocket, you assemble to it a guidance system that connects to a Russian GPS system, and that turns it into a more accurate. But given the fact that they were challenged there as well by us and also some technical challenge, they decided to move a step further and establish in Lebanon facilities to build the whole missile from scratch, not to convert it, but to build it from scratch. And that explains the recent strike in Beirut, the first of its kind in many years, because according to media publication, what was targeted in Beirut was an 8-ton mixer that mixes the fuels for that rocket, and Israel, whoever carried that strike, had a narrow window of opportunity before it was taken to an underground site, and that explains what happened in Beirut. In addition, there were a series of strikes in Iraq on bases belonging to Shiite militias, probably also part of that precision project. And while Israel never assumed official responsibility, there were hints, also some leaks from America, that it may be responsible for at least some of these strikes. And in addition, Iran, desiring to respond to what Israel was doing, planned and tried to carry out an attack of armed drones from Syria to Israel. It wasn't the first counter-strike by Iran. In early 2018, they sent an armed drone to Israel, which was shot down, and then Israel took out important parts of their infrastructure, military infrastructure in Syria. In May 2018, they fired 32 rockets from Syria to the Golan Heights. Only four crossed the line and were intercepted. In January 2019, they fired an accurate rocket towards Mount Hermon in broad daylight, and when thousands of Israelis were there at the ski site. And now this plan to send armed drones to Israel, which was thwarted by an IDF strike, this time Israel assumed full responsibility. So the meaning of what happened recently is that, on the one hand, Iran expanded the borders of its own campaign against Israel and shifted focus from Syria to additional arenas like Iraq and Lebanon. And in response, Israel also expanded its own campaign against what the Iranians were trying to do. And the main Israeli focus is on the precision project, be it in Syria, in Lebanon, or elsewhere. Assuming media reports about the strike in Beirut are correct, and assuming that Israel had a hand in it, this, of course, poses a challenge to Hezbollah, because in their mind, it changes the equation of so-called mutual deterrence. It's the first time since 2006 that Hezbollah is targeted in Beirut. And obviously, as Nasrallah said in a public speech, they cannot allow this to remain unanswered, because if they do, they erode their own deterrence. In fact, Hezbollah, in a number of speeches, emphasized the point about what he called strategic balance, meaning mutual deterrence between Hezbollah and Israel, including a recent speech where he cited a paragraph from an article I wrote for the Washington Institute about this kind of deterrence, how they can deter Israel. And this act in Beirut, coupled with the fact that the two guys who were killed in our strike in Syria against that cell that was about to launch armed drones to Israel were originally Hezbollah guys, so he felt compelled to respond. However, it is also clear that Hezbollah is not interested in escalating to war with Israel. They stand a lot to lose. I don't think Iran wants to throw them into that fray because they need Hezbollah as a deterrent against either Israel or the U.S. striking their nuclear facilities. Iran and Hezbollah are under very heavy economic pressure. There's economic crisis in Lebanon. There's a lot of pressure domestically in Lebanon against Hezbollah. They're definitely not interested in war. So they calculated their response in a way that, in their mind, does not lead to escalation. They fired along the border, not deep into Israel. They focused on military targets, a military base, military vehicles, and so on. And they were quick to contain that round, so it ended the way it ended. There was also, one has to admit, a luck element because they fired at an armored medical vehicle with five soldiers in it, and they missed. But ultimately, it was clear that they do not seek escalation. But the potential for escalation is there because you have two determined actors, Iran on the one hand and Israel on the other hand, and none of us is going to give up, and Iran will try and continue to push, especially its precision project, and Israel will continue to push back, and things could escalate either in the bilateral context between us and Hezbollah or us and Iran. It could escalate in Syria, it could escalate in Lebanon, as we've seen now, or in other theaters. They could try and respond from Gaza, where they have some control over some of the factions like Jihad Islami. They, as Nasrallah vowed, will try and down Israeli drones or even planes in Lebanon. It's quite clear that this is their intention, and we have to be careful there. And things could also escalate in the context of tensions between the United States and Iran. There are a lot of tensions, both in the nuclear field and regionally. We've seen some violent Iranian actions in the Gulf, in Iraq, and elsewhere. I think we may face some challenges in both Lebanon and Iraq, because when it comes to Syria, I think the rules of the game are clear. We have intelligence dominance, we have operation dominance, and we've been quite successful. But in Lebanon, it's more complicated because the chances of escalation directly between Israel and Hezbollah are higher than in Syria, because in Lebanon it's us against them. And if Iran and Hezbollah continue with this precision project in Lebanon, then I assume that the Israeli government will be faced with a dilemma, because on the one hand, you don't want to let it pass. On the other hand, you realize that if you take military action, it may escalate to war. We'll have to find the right way to deal with it, as we have done now in the recent incident. As far as Iraq is concerned, and again, I'm not in a position to deny or to confirm whether Israel acted in Iraq, but I think the context for what happened in Iraq is quite clear. But there, the sensitivity emanates from the fact that there are American forces in Iraq, and we have to take that into consideration. Obviously, some elements in the U.S. government are not fully happy with the potential of Israeli action in Iraq, and there have been leaks. But I don't think that if Israel sees an unbearable situation or challenge, a military challenge facing it, that it will stop taking action against Iran. Finally, I just want to comment that against this background of increased tension between us and Hezbollah and between us and Iran, we constantly see some European initiatives, especially French initiatives, to bring about negotiations between the United States and Iran on the nuclear issue. We've seen President Macron take some action. My comment on this, while I'm not against the very idea of dialogue, it has to be based on very, very solid foundations. It cannot be that Iranians get paid just for coming to the table, and that what they are doing in the region against Israel and against other regional actors is being ignored in such a discussion. It has to be factored in into any discussion with Iran if that takes place. Let me stop here and open for Q&A.
Thank you so much, Michael. That was absolutely comprehensive and, of course, brilliant, but yeah, I expected no less from you. As a moderator, I'm going to take the liberty of asking the first question, and that is over the last several years, America has been giving more than $1.7 billion, over $100 million a year to the Lebanese armed forces. I have brought this up with many, many members of Congress and staffers on Capitol Hill on both sides of the aisle. And we're really concerned about whether or not any of this money will fall into the hands of Hezbollah. What is the Israeli government's feeling about the relationship between the Lebanese armed forces and Hezbollah today?
Well, there's a lot of concern in Israel about Hezbollah's standing in Lebanon and the relations between the Lebanese government, or the Lebanese state and Hezbollah, and the Lebanese army and Hezbollah. What we've seen in recent years is that Hezbollah has become stronger politically in Lebanon. It is a stronger political party. It is part of the Lebanese government. They have a veto power over decisions in the Lebanese government. I think they've taken control of the official line of the Lebanese state as regards defense issues. We've seen certainly President Michel Aoun is there. Is an ally of Hezbollah,
yeah.
Political ally, and he's been stating officially that Hezbollah's military capabilities are, you know, will complement the capabilities of the state of Lebanon. So the state embraces Hezbollah as a military actor, and we've even seen increased cooperation between the Lebanese army and Hezbollah in certain areas, like the coordinated attack against Islamists in northern Lebanon, northern Syria a few years ago. We've seen recently when Israel discovered cross-border tunnels from Lebanon to Israel, and UNIFIL tried to approach those tunnels in southern Lebanon. They were prevented by the Lebanese army. There are other examples of cooperation between them. So this raises a lot of concern. Now, I think this calls for rethinking the policy of aid to Lebanon. I'm not suggesting to stop all aid, but you have to think very carefully what you provide and under what terms. When you provide something to the Lebanese army or the Lebanese state, what should be those terms? On the one hand, I must say that the U.S. sanctions against Hezbollah applied by the U.S. are quite effective, and taken together with sanctions on Iran, they have resulted in a decreased budget. They're certainly undergoing experiencing economic difficulties, but I think that's not enough. You cannot continue and look at Lebanon as a whole and Lebanese army as if they are totally independent, and I think this calls for rethinking of military aid, especially that is given to Lebanon. Israel is not being very vocal about this, but I know that there are a lot of concerns. And there's a lot of concerns also about the mandate of UNIFIL, because UNIFIL has proven itself ineffective in southern Lebanon, and they refrain from going into villages and so on, and that's also a cause of concern here in Israel.
Thank you very much. I am going to hand this over to my colleague, Sarah Leah Thompson, who will be reading the questions that have come in. If anybody wants to ask any further questions, please press star 6.
Okay, so we have a few questions that have already been submitted, the first of which are, there are many land and border disputes all over the world. Does the international community tolerate and encourage attacks on Israel and its citizens to the same extent or differently than the extent to which it tolerates and encourages attacks on the sovereignty and citizens of other parties to land and border disputes? Let me just see that Michael is still able to speak.
Yes.
Okay, here we can hear you now, Michael. Hi.
Yeah.
Thanks for your patience
okay.
there.
I was saying that we do have a border and a land border and a maritime border dispute with Lebanon, but I don't think this is a cause of the recent violent events. I mean, the cause is it's not a border dispute, it's Iranian design to ultimately destroy the state of Israel, to build, to surround Israel with military funds that put pressure on Israel, and ultimately, in a long historical process, destroy Israel. And the fact is that, as pertains to the border dispute, Lebanon recently indicated its willingness to go into mediation, international mediation efforts as regards the border. And when it comes to the maritime border, there's a lot of gas involved as well, which is of interest to them. So I wouldn't frame what's happening between us and Hezbollah, Lebanon, and Iran behind it as merely a border dispute. It goes much more than that. I think, at least in this case, many actors in the region and internationally understand exactly what's happening and are concerned about the Iranian designs. We see unprecedented voices of support in the region to Israel's right to self-defense, including the foreign minister of Bahrain and some additional voices in Lebanon criticizing Hezbollah. So I think, at least in our region, those actors who are concerned about Iran understand what the Iranians are trying to do and what we are trying to do. And support what we are trying to do, because our actions against Iran also serve their interest.
Great. Thank you so much. The next question we have is, on how many fronts is Israel waging war on Iran? Also, how effective has the computer hacking campaign been, and have similar tactics been used on Hezbollah?
Okay, the campaign that we are at against Iran, or the showdown between Israel and Iran, has been taking place in several fronts, in Lebanon, in Syria, according to media reports in Iraq, in Gaza. It's not that Gaza is a full Israel-Iran showdown. There are other elements, there's Hamas and so on. But in Gaza, there are pro-Iran elements that get funds and support from Iran and sometimes guidelines. And I suspect that in some of the rocket firing incidents in recent months, there were Iranian hands as well. Iran has been trying to attack us also in the cyber front, not very successfully, but we feel their hands. And Iran and Hezbollah have been building or trying to build. They were thwarted in most cases. The option to carry out terror attacks against us globally. Recently, there were reports about Hezbollah's attempt to establish terror infrastructure in Europe, which was thwarted in most cases. And they built that capacity towards the day when they will need it, according to their thinking. So we have many fronts between us and Iran. And here I want to say something. The Iranians have been trying to place threats on our borders. But until today, they felt that their own home front was immune. And there are more and more voices in Israel's defense establishment today saying that they should not feel immune. Actually, their biggest vulnerability is their own home front. And in case of war, a future war between Israel and Iranian proxies or Israel and Iran, we should not shy away from looking at their own front as well. So that's another element that has to be added into the equation, at least in terms of planning.
Thank you for that insight. The next question we have is, do you think the timing of any of the recent events is because of the upcoming election with Netanyahu using it to get reelected?
Well, look, I've been, I served for many years in the IDF and the Ministry of Defense. I don't believe, in my experience, that the very decision to take action, such as we've seen recently, is a political decision, namely that someone is playing with let's say, lives of soldiers and so on for political purposes. When such decisions are taken, it's not that politicians take them alone. They sit down with the defense establishment. There are serious deliberations. They discuss the issue and so on, and they reach a decision. Obviously, if media reports are accurate and to be believed, there was a concrete reason for those attacks. I mean, the Iranians were about to launch armed drones on Israel, and we needed to thwart them. And if media reports about this 8-ton mixer in Lebanon, which is designed to create accurate rockets, if these reports are correct, then I can understand the reason why someone decided to take action. I'm not saying that when politicians talk about these actions, they don't have politics in their mind, but I do not believe for a moment that the very decision to take action here or there was motivated by politics. There was a real defense reason against it. There was a real challenge necessitating it, and that decision was taken.
Great, thank you. We have one more pre-submitted questions before we'll be able to open up to our Q&A for those who are on the conference call with us. So the last question we have is there an estimate of Hezbollah capability for sustained rocket volley swarm rate?
Yes, as I noted earlier, according to Israel's intelligence, Hezbollah holds to an arsenal of about 130 projectiles, namely missiles, rockets, and mortars. And according to the IDF threat reference, namely it's a reference point against which the IDF builds its own forces, they can fire at Israel averagely 1,500 rockets a day, across the state of Israel for weeks. That is why a future confrontation with Hezbollah will be a different ball game than anything we have experienced, because our home front will be severely challenged. Ultimately, I believe, and the IDF believes, that in a future confrontation we will have the upper hand, because the IDF revolutionized its own capabilities and is capable of taking out thousands of targets a day, much beyond anything we have known in the past. The connectivities between the various branches and agencies is very different than anything we have known. But we also realize that in a future confrontation, while we will prevail, and I believe in that, we'll pay a heavy price. We'll pay a much heavier price.
Thank you. So now we can... Yes, so now we'll be able to open up the Q&A to our first person who has a question, Barry Heyman. So, Barry, you should be able to speak now.
Yeah, this is Ellen Heyman. I was wondering what your assessment of the state of play of the European attitude is towards Hezbollah and Iran. Iranian intentions seem so clear, and yet there's an enormous, flirtation and apology for Hezbollah and for Iran, despite its genocidal aims. How do you understand the European view on this?
Well, I'm not surprised by the European attitude. We've seen it for years. As far as Hezbollah is concerned, I must say that we saw the beginning of some change not long ago, when the UK government decided to designate the whole of Hezbollah, both the political and the military wings, as terrorists. Unlike most Europeans and the European Union, who designate only the military wing of Hezbollah as terrorists and not the political wing, it's a long story, but it's as if you designate one arm and not the other. Both of them are, of course, governed by the same head. And other Europeans are pushing back. When it comes to Iran, I think the main European concern is they are afraid that if the U.S. campaign of maximum pressure on Iran persists, that the Iran will increasingly abandon the nuclear deal, ultimately abandon it totally, and these things could escalate. And I think their view on this is very short-sighted. We've recently seen President Macron of France trying to orchestrate a dialogue between the United States and Iran. If I understand correctly, his game plan, it was to get Iran to backtrack from its recent violation of the JCPOA in return for a line of credit of $15 billion, which is a lot of money, kind of ease the burden of sanctions. But that doesn't constitute a solid basis for negotiations. And as I said earlier, I don't believe for a minute that Iran should be rewarded for just sitting down and talking, having taken its recent measures both in the region and in the nuclear field. I think the best policy in this case is for the U.S. to articulate very clear conditions for talking to the Iranians. What are the aim of such a dialogue? And the aim should be to fix the deficiencies, the basic deficiencies of the JCPOA, and to not reward Iran for just sitting down and talking. On that basis, I think if the U.S. sticks to that basis, there's not very much that the Europeans can do. They've been trying to provide an economic cushion to Iran, but with very, very modest success, because the fact is that European companies have made their decision. If they have to decide between trade with the U.S. and trade with Iran, their decision is clear. They opt for trade with the United States, and the biggest European companies opted out of the Iranian market. And there's not very much that the Iranians can do to save Iran. We've seen recently an Iranian effort to establish a trade tool, INSTEX, that will enable Iran to trade through barter, not through dollars, and so on. But that too, against the background of American pressure, provides only for some humanitarian needs, like medical needs and so on, but does not answer the Iranian desire to be able to export oil and so on. So I think the pressure continues, and I would hope that in talking about dialogue between the United States and Iran, that dialogue, from a U.S. point of view, should be based on very, very solid terms, and it should be clarified that the aim of such a dialogue is to fix the deficiencies of the JCPOA without rewarding Iran for its own violations.
Great.
Thank you so much, Michael. I have one further question, and that's Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif recently said that he is stepping up the nuclear production to 20%. The uranium production to 20%. How much of a window does that allow the international community before Iran reaches total nuclear capacity?
Well, Iran is playing brinkmanship since the U.S. decided to exit the JCPOA and apply a campaign of maximum pressure. So they have been, beginning last May or this May, started encroaching on their commitments to the JCPOA, first increasing enrichment from 3.67% to 4.5%, and now threatening to go up to 20%. They've been there before the JCPOA. And let me remind you that 20% is a very dangerous phase towards what we call breakout capacity, namely one bomb's worth of military-grade material. The critical phase is reaching 20% with a specific amount. I will remind you that a few years back, when the Iranians were enriching to 20% and increased their the stockpile of 20% enriched uranium, our Prime Minister, Mr. Netanyahu, went to the UN and issued a red line, a public red line, namely that if Iran acquires 20% enriched uranium beyond a certain amount, that will be considered by Israel as a red line. I think his warning at the time was taken seriously by Iran. So I suspect that if Iran resume enrichment to 20%, it will bring back to the fore the talk about potential measures to thwart the Iranian nuclear program, including potential military measures. I suspect that the international community will not do much beyond perhaps more sanctions. If Iran enriches to 20%, it may somewhat undermine its own position with the Europeans. But ultimately, if economic sanctions do not stop Iran from further enrichment, then, as I said earlier, you'll probably hear more about other options, including the military options. And here we talk mainly about Israel.
Thank you so much. I'd like to just sum up to all of our listeners that we're living in incredibly precarious times right now. I want to thank Brigadier General Mike Herzog for his really brilliant analysis. And I'd like our listeners to know that we really, really depend on contributions. We really believe that knowledge is power. And Amet's entire mission is to bring this knowledge to members of Congress, their staffers, the administration, and the public at large in order for us to make well-informed decisions. And so thank you so much. Anybody who wants to contribute to us can go to www.ametonline.org. But moreover, I want to thank Mike Herzog for being a phenomenal friend to Amet and to the international community, that, and also a tremendous strategic asset for the State of Israel. Thank you so much for your wonderful contributions for all of us.
Thank you very much. Thank you all.
Okay. Bye-bye now.